This is The Political Scene, a weekly conversation with New Yorker writers and editors about politics. It's Thursday, December 14th. I'm Dorothy Wickenden, executive editor of The New Yorker. On Tuesday, in one of the most controversial Senate races in memory, a moderate Democrat, Doug Jones, beat the far-right candidate Roy Moore. It's been 25 years since a Democrat has been elected to the Senate in Alabama. Republicans normally win by more than 500,000 votes. Moore's campaign unraveled after five women came forward charging that he'd pursued them when they were teenagers, including one who says that he molested her when she was 14. Charles Bethea has been reporting on the race from Alabama. On election night, just before polls closed, he spoke with Leisha Brooks, the director of the Civil Rights Memorial Center.
I don't think I've seen this kind of excitement at an election or about an election since Obama in 2008. For a special election, it's pretty incredible, actually. There's an electricity in there. It's kind of exciting. I want to be hopeful. I've been a resident of Alabama for 14 years, and I've never felt that my vote counted before today. The fact is that it's really hard for progressives or people who believe in or promote social justice to stay engaged in the democratic process voting in a state like Alabama.
Charles joins me to discuss his experience covering the special election and what Moore's defeat reveals about Trumpism in the South. Welcome, Charles.
Thanks for having me.
I've been wanting to talk to you for quite a long time, so this seems like a good moment. You have covered the race closely. You've talked to people all around the state since the start. Maybe begin by telling us about Moore's history in Alabama. Everyone knows he was removed twice from the Alabama Supreme Court. How has he come to be seen within the Republican Party in the state?
Well, backing up just a little for some context that might be useful.
Yes, please.
Alabama doesn't have a sterling history of electing progressive candidates for office, or even electing what most of the rest of the country would call moderates. Politically, it's a state that's best known for its so-called Dixiecrat four-term Governor George Wallace, the longtime segregationist who in his first inaugural address in 1963 said to his constituents, segregation now, segregation tomorrow, segregation forever. He eventually renounced segregation, but his social conservatism is still very much alive in the state. It was embraced by Robert Bentley, the ex-governor forced to resign earlier this year after a sex and ethics scandal, who was against gay marriages and civil unions, who voted no on adding sexual orientation to hate crime criteria, and who was against affirmative action for colleges and state contracts. Attorney General Jeff Sessions, Alabama's junior senator for 20 years, was known as one of the most conservative senators during his tenure. Among other things, he was also hostile to LGBTQ rights. So when Sessions was tapped to join Trump's administration, and suddenly there's an open Senate seat, you've got a bunch of Republicans trying to get to the right of each other and hug Trump the tightest. As we know, it came down to Luther Strange, a former state attorney general better known for defending ExxonMobil than the rights of his state's gay and minority citizens, and a twice-removed, Bible-thumping former state Supreme Court justice named Roy Moore. Until a few months ago, Moore was best known for his refusal to remove a Ten Commandments monument from the rotunda of the state judicial building where he brazenly had it installed. I imagine he now wishes that's what people first think of when hearing his name.
So he also is I think it's fair to say that he makes no secret at all about his racism. I mean, his nostalgia for the days of slavery is right out there.
Yeah, he never, in the course of running for Senate, he never really spoke to African-Americans in a way that I think felt like genuine support and empathy for their concerns and for their history in the state. And his sort of romanticizing the pre-Civil War South certainly didn't help. And I only saw a few African-Americans, as I was reporting from his rallies and such, who were willing to come out and say that they liked him and try to explain why.
Moore stopped campaigning in the final weeks, and he left it to his surrogate and Trump's, Steve Bannon. How was Bannon received by Republican voters?
Well, you know, Republican voters, there's quite a few kinds in the state. But among Moore supporting Republican voters, Bannon was sort of a hero and sort of a rock star even. I went to a rally in Fairhope, Alabama, about a week and a half ago. that Bannon was headlining. Bannon was very much the star. It was clear that from listening to him speak that he was actually able to engage with and move voters in Alabama probably more effectively than Roy Moore, which is why, among other reasons, Roy Moore disappeared from the stage in the final weeks, because I think those who were on his strategic team had a feeling that he was more likely to sort of make a gaffe or stumble in some way rather than help his cause.
Yeah, so talk about your coverage specifically about the Gadsden Mall.
Yeah, so Gadsden is in the north of the state. It's a small, woodsy, blue-collar, really religious and Republican town in Etowah County, which voted for Trump three times as many folks voted for Trump as Clinton. It's a place where you see Confederate flags when you drive around and that sort of thing. There's one single mall there, and I spent 4 or 5 hours looking around the mall and quite a bit longer talking to locals in Gadsden after hearing from a few credible sources that Moore was a concerning presence there in the early 80s when he was a district attorney in his early 30s. Around the time the Post came out with its huge story about Alabama women who alleged that when they were teenagers, Moore sexually assaulted or molested them or just scared them, I began to speak with local cops, lawyers, former Gadsden Mall employees, and mall patrons. The vast majority of those I spoke to confirmed that Moore was known for harassing teenage girls at the mall. Some spoke of a ban that for some amount of time was in place, attempting to prevent the young attorney from bothering teenage girls who congregated there. I never found a piece of paper dating back to those days listing names, including Moore's, that were banned from the mall, if such a piece of paper even existed. But what was clear from my reporting is that one of the most powerful men in town in the early 80s was a troublesome presence at the mall.
Hi, it's David Remnick. If you're enjoying this podcast, you might enjoy even more of what The New Yorker has to offer. Becoming a subscriber gives you unlimited access to The New Yorker, including Pulitzer Prize-winning reporting, insightful cultural commentary, and fiction and poetry. You'll also enjoy our delightful cartoons, crossword puzzles, narrated stories, and much more. This past year, our readers were gripped by Ronan Farrow's profile of Elon Musk, Heidi Blake's extraordinary tale about Dubai's runaway princesses, and much more. Visit newyorker.com to gain access to all this and more. Use the code POD15, P-O-D-1-5, to secure a 15% discount on a yearly digital subscription. That's POD15 for a 15% discount.
Were you surprised by the results, given the reporting you've done?
I, like I guess most folks, in the wake of the Trump-Clinton election, I didn't see polls or polling as being necessarily as credible as perhaps we have in the past. And I just know, having grown up next to Alabama, how conservative it is. And
you grew up in Georgia?
I grew up in Atlanta, yeah. In Atlanta, we, in Georgia, generally, we have a saying, thank God for Alabama, because it constantly makes us look better. So, you know, I was surprised. I figured Moore would pull it out. I mean, as I look back now, especially in the reporting I did in the final days of the campaign, there was evidence that, particularly among African Americans that I spoke to and young folks that I spoke to, that there was more enthusiasm and momentum against Moore in the closing days than there was for Moore. So that helps explain what happened.
You spoke to a number of conservative women who really despised him, which interested me. Was there a big gender gap in the results? And if so, how do you parse it?
So the conversation I had with the conversations, rather, I had with women who voted and in some cases even worked for conservative candidates for their entire lives and were unwilling to support Moore were telling, I thought. So Robert Bentley, former governor of Alabama, who got in trouble with the sex and ethics scandal earlier this year and had to resign, someone who worked for him and truly believed in him, a woman who helped elect him, in fact, told me a few weeks ago, just after it was revealed that Moore had co-authored a legal textbook stating that women shouldn't hold political office, She said, you know what, that was the last straw for me. He can kiss my ass. Those were the words she used. I took that as quite a sign and quite telling.
There is a temptation for Democrats to read perhaps too much in the results for 2018 and beyond. I mean, the euphoria with which this was greeted. On the other hand, the ramifications for the national political parties seem pretty clear, given the troubles that Donald Trump is continuing to face, his own accusations by numerous women of sexual harassment and sexual assault.
Yeah. In the weeks prior to the election, as I interviewed voters leaving the polls yesterday, I heard folks, including many moderate Republicans like Shelby, the senior senator in Alabama, say they were tired of being embarrassed and miscast by their politicians. As one voter put it to me, he said, "We're tired of everyone thinking we're dumbasses." Young Republicans in particular expressed frustration with the bigoted ideas and concerning behaviors associated with Moore. While many wanted the conservative Supreme Court justices that Moore would likely have voted for, they weren't willing to sacrifice their state's already, quote, backwards reputation. So again, I do think that moving forward, Republicans in the state and also the national level are going to have to really see that for what it means and see it for what it is and should be concerned, I think, especially with the young voters.
And this does follow the gubernatorial and legislative victories in Virginia in November. And also national polls are beginning to show that Trump's popularity is falling among evangelicals, swing voters, and even, you know, other sort of core Trump voters. So do you see any bigger lessons here, or is this isolated to this moment in time, and would Moore perhaps have won if these allegations didn't emerge at, you know, this crucial point in his campaign?
Well, I think he very well may have won if these allegations hadn't emerged and if he wasn't such a poor candidate in so many ways. But I think in terms of moving forward, there are some things that have happened that are continue to have a ripple effect in future races in the state and in the South, probably. A big one is, you know, the groups that have been sort of awakened and mobilized, the progressive groups, to stop a candidate like Moore. Among them were the state NAACP, which reportedly instructed its local branches to call every registered voter in the state who did not vote in the 2016 presidential election. There were also groups like one called Woke Vote locally and the Working Families Party nationally that helped lead to high Democrat turnout numbers, particularly in African-American communities. This morning, I spoke with the political director of Indivisible, the national progressive group that's been organizing resistance to the Trump agenda. And they had five groups in Alabama of varying sizes that helped turn out the vote in six counties. I was told that they knocked on 5,500 Democrat doors. And I think they had 1,500 of their out-of-state members help send what amounted to nearly a quarter of a million texts to likely Democrat voters. And the group's multi-pronged effort ultimately helped flip three counties from Trump to Jones. And in three other counties, they trimmed Trump's margins from last November by 18 points.
You know, it's interesting that the Republican Party was caught so flat-footed. I guess it really was only, what, a month or two ago that it just seemed inconceivable that Doug Jones could win.
Yeah, I think so. I mean, and Steve Bannon acknowledged as much, I think, this morning. I saw a story quoting him saying something like, "Democrats outworked Republicans," and I think his quote was, "You've got to give the devil its due." Yeah, it's pretty clear the Republicans kind of phoned this one in, so to speak. I think, as one volunteer for the Jones campaign put it to me, a guy from Massachusetts said, as soon as he saw a cowboy waving around his little pistol on stage after he beat Luther Strange, he thought that, you know what, the Democrats could steal this thing.
Thanks so much, Charles.
Hey, thanks a lot.
Charles Bethay is a contributing writer for NewYorker.com and has been writing for the magazine since 2008. This has been The Political Scene from The New Yorker. You can subscribe to this and other New Yorker podcasts by searching for The New Yorker in your podcast app and find more political analysis and commentary on NewYorker.com. Feel free to rate and review The Political Scene on Apple Podcasts. This podcast is produced by Alex Barron for NewYorker.com with help from Hannah Wilentz. I'm Dorothy Wickenden.